KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, the Marin Institute in San Rafael released a report which for the first time provides overall cost estimates for alcohol-related problems in the state. Alcohol costs far outpace the costs associated with natural disasters such as fires and earthquakes and exceeds tobacco-related costs. We'll find out why in the hour ahead and what the report is advocating for prevention and reduction, as well as finding out what the exact costs are and how they're calculated. Forum is next, with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Yesterday, the self-described industry watchdog Marin Institute, located in San Rafael, held a news conference in Los Angeles to announce the results of a peer-reviewed study, which they titled The Annual Catastrophe of Alcohol in California. We find out from the study, in the first comprehensive study really of its kind, including all kinds of effects, and recommendations for a tax on alcohol, and bottom-line figures such as moderate to high alcohol consumption by residents of the state costing the California economy $38 billion a year and resulting in 9,439 deaths. There's much more in this study about annual costs of alcohol problems, relationship between alcohol consumption and illness, injury, crime, traffic collisions. That's why I'm calling it overall probably the most comprehensive of its kind. Also, cost estimate with respect to, well, work loss from deaths and the cost of fetal alcohol syndrome and risky sexual behavior. It's gone into a lot of dimensions of the problem, and we want to find out more about it in this hour and also hear from some dissenting voices. Michelle Simon is with us in studio. She is Research and Policy Director for the Marin Institute, and she is co-author of this study, and she joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us in studio is Fred Whitman, who is a specialist with the Institute for the Study of Social Change at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's Project Director for the Community Prevention Planning Project and a member of the State Advisory Committee to California Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Edward Stringham is with us by phone. He's an associate professor of economics with San Jose State University, editor of two books, author of a couple dozen articles in reference journals, including the Journal of Institutional and Theoretical Economics, Quarterly Review of Economics and Finance, and the Journal of Labor Research. And welcome, Professor Stringham.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I ought to mention that we went to a good deal of trouble to get spokespeople for the alcohol industry. We call DISCUS, the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S., the California Beer and Beverage Distributors, the American Beverage Institute, the California Beer and Beverage Distributors, and on it goes, California Wine Institute, Anheuser-Busch, et cetera, all declined. But I should mention that Professor Stringham was actually recommended to us by DISCUS. That doesn't necessarily mean that he has an affiliation, though. We'll find out perhaps in the course of this hour. I want to begin, though, with the co-author of the study, Michelle Simon, who, as I said, is with us here in studio, and these are pretty startling statistics. Every hour somebody dies of alcohol in California, those kinds of things. Tell us how you get these numbers, because it's a peer-reviewed study.
Yes, it was. And we based our study on methodology that has been published by the federal government and many other published reports. So we're not really inventing anything new here. We're simply putting numbers to a very human and real problem that people know is happening every day because so many people are affected. So what we did was break down the various types of harm. And what is so staggering about alcohol is, unlike some other health and safety problems that may only cause, say, health like tobacco, alcohol causes such an array of harm. So breaking it down, as you mentioned, illnesses, crime, traffic, and injury, we looked at each of those components of alcohol-involved incidents and then looked at the costs associated with each of them. And it was, you know, extremely detail intensive to be looking at the cost, say, of a hospitalization when someone is in the hospital with liver disease. How much does that cost? When someone is a victim of crime, how much does that cost in mental anguish, et cetera. So very detailed looks at each of these different categories of harm caused by alcohol, and then within them, various types of costs.
How do you determine, for example, something like violent crime and its relationship to alcohol use?
That one does have a little bit of challenges to it. And what we did was we based it on previously published estimates that looked at survey results of people in prison, and they're asked simply whether they drank alcohol at the time of the crime, when the crime was committed. Of course, that's not enough, because just because alcohol is involved in a crime doesn't mean that it actually caused the crime. So then we reduce that percentage by about half to really give a more conservative estimate of a alcohol-involved crime. And I know your other guest actually has a little bit more expertise about crime-related statistics, but that is just one methodology to be able to get to that question.
Well, also, I'm just interested just in the methodology now for the moment. Workplace costs come out at the highest, staggering number, $25.3 billion, and you determine that how?
Yes. Well, that is staggering, and that is based on previously published reports by the federal government that determine that people who are currently alcohol dependent or surprisingly ever been alcohol dependent and are even in recovery have roughly a reduction in their earnings of $433 a month. So that means that even if you've recovered from alcohol dependence, over the rest of your life, you will see a reduction on average of $433 a month in your earnings. So it's a combination of those reduced earnings of being alcohol dependent, but also the reduced productivity of so many people who are injured from alcohol, have a lifetime of disability. So people who are essentially out of work, suffering from the effects of alcohol, their lost wages, the lost fringe benefits, as well as what was startling to me, which is over $1 billion in lost tax revenue to the state of California. So that means the state revenue is being harmed to the tune of $1 billion alone in tax revenue.
Also talking about a lot of pain and suffering, of course, related to alcohol, which is, of course, difficult to measure in terms of families and in terms of loved ones and all of that. Binge drinking also turns out to be, at least according to your study, and that's, you have a specific definition, 5 or more drinks for men and 4 or more for women, turns out to be an extraordinary problem.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point to make, because I think too often people still think of alcohol as alcoholism or alcohol abuse, which is a term we don't even like to use, when in fact most harmful drinking is caused by binge drinking, which means you don't have to have an addiction. You don't have to have a diagnosed problem necessarily to be a binge drinker who, of course, then can get into a lot of trouble. And we found that the statistics in California show, startlingly, about 24% of males are binge drinkers. And as you said, as defined by drinking 5 or more drinks in one on one occasion. And so the problems due to alcohol really go beyond just any one kind of definition.
Well, and you also make a strong recommendation, number of recommendations, but one of the strongest recommendations is to put a tax on alcohol. And, of course, the argument immediately comes to the surface. Why put a tax on alcohol to hurt those moderate drinkers when it's the abusive drinkers who are causing the greatest problems?
Well, actually, we do have taxes on alcohol, and there are taxes
on alcohol
in every state.
Right.
So we are talking about raising the taxes because in California, the beer tax, for example, is 20 cents a gallon, and that is below the national average, and it's way below how other countries tax alcohol. And if you look at who the drinkers are who are causing the problems, it's really a small part of the population. So roughly half of people who do drink, and by the way, about a third of the population doesn't drink at all, so they're not even, they wouldn't be affected, at least economically, by a tax increase. Of those who do drink, about half drink 95% of the alcohol. So that means we have a relatively small number of people who are drinking to excess, and that's who we really want to affect
to
with
pay
higher
the lion's share with higher taxes.
Absolutely.
Of course, Assemblyman Jim Beal proposed a beer tax, and they've been calling him, you know, another liberal jerk, a clown, all kinds of names. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere either at this point.
Right. But if you look at the science, and the reason we selected alcohol taxes to really recommend very highly is that that's what the science shows. Of all the data that we have on the most effective policies to reduce the harm from drinking, alcohol taxes really rises to the top.
Does that conform with your studies, Fried Wittman?
Yes, it does. Actually, I have a comment about the law enforcement, police, and corrections data. I think the another way of constructing the estimates is to take a look at the amount of alcohol involvement in police events. We've studied local police activity and find that roughly 20 to 25% of calls for service involve alcohol-related activities, and roughly 40 to 60% of arrests involve alcohol. So that's another way of estimating some of the costs. It also shows how the use of alcohol is just embedded into everyday life. What Michelle was saying about a relatively small number of people accounting for a large amount of the consumption applies also in taking a look at problems. We found with looking at alcohol outlets, for example, in a given community that roughly 10% of the outlets will account for around 50% of all the calls for service to the outlets. So the metric in looking at taxation or some kind of cost recovery system is to recognize that a few places and a relatively small proportion of drinkers account for a lot of the service costs and a lot of the problematic activity. A very efficient way of leveraging the costs into service activities would be to charge at a per drink basis, or some way of charging the people who are drinking the most directly for the kinds of problems that they're being caused. That can be done in a variety of ways, of course, but I think the basic point that Michelle is making is quite accurate from our findings.
No, there haven't been alcohol taxes since 1992, and that was only a penny a drink. So the lobbying has been very successful here.
Yeah.
The other thing, just economically, is, well, you had a similar study in 2004 that you headed up, I believe, didn't you?
Yes, it used 2001 data from the state of California. We did it under a small grant from the Schwab Foundation, did it in conjunction with Wendy Max, a health economist at UC San Francisco, who did the health costs, and I looked at the corrections and public safety costs. The numbers we came up with using 2001 data, and also very conservative figures. We didn't look at, for example, in any detail at quality of life issues. We just looked at the health costs for medical treatment, for alcohol and drug prevention and treatment services, and for corrections costs, police costs, and estimates from the number of people in prison about the involvement of alcohol in criminal activity. That all added up to about $17 billion. And it was about $11 billion for the health care costs and about $7 billion for the safety costs.
The figure that the state deficit is at, roughly around...
That's an interesting coincidence, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
And we also figured in that same report that looking at the annual consumption of alcohol in California, that adding 18 cents a drink to people's consumption would pretty much erase that deficit.
Well, looking at economics for a moment, in 2007, the alcohol industry generated over $22 billion in sales revenue in California. That's about $10.3 billion from beer and $7.4 from spirits and $5.1 from wine. And most of the profits left California.
We didn't study that, so I'll just have to.
I mean, Michelle,
yes.
You want to
comment? Well, increasingly, the alcohol industry is globalized. And we had the last breath of a U.S.-based company, Anheuser-Busch, just fell last week to InBev, a global company. And so now we have pretty much, you know, all the beer of the major beer companies owned by foreign conglomerates.
And you have essentially some figures that suggest that if there were a tax, let's say 25 cents per drink, it would generate an additional $3 billion a year, but also it would reduce consumption by 9%. That would be, you know, an extraordinary number of deaths and injuries and crimes.
Correct. And I think it's important
to
know.
Where do you come up with figures like that? I mean, how do you quantify something like
sure.
that?
Sure. Well, the revenue is easy enough to generate. That's just based on sales.
No, but I mean the reduction.
The reduction is based on what economists like to refer to as elasticity, which is a measure of how sensitive people are to price. So it's basically when you raise prices, people respond accordingly. It's, you know, simple supply and demand price type of calculation. So in other words, we know that when you raise prices, especially with young people, and, you know, one of the Institute of Medicine has identified higher taxes as the most effective strategy to reduce underage drinking. So just like raising taxes and hence prices on cigarettes reduces teen smoking, raising prices taxes and hence prices on alcohol reduces underage drinking. So it's basically that kind of calculation.
And who funded your study,
the Marin Institute? The Marin Institute is funded privately by the Buck Institute. Okay. I'm sorry, by the Buck Trust.
And you mentioned Schwab before, Fried Wittman, in terms of the 2004 study you did. Now you're involved in helping agencies at state and city level to take advantage of zoning ordinances to control liquor. Who's funding you?
Right. We're funded at this point by county alcohol and drug programs in California. We've also had considerable funding from the State Department of Alcohol and Drug Programs.
Okay, I want to bring Edward Stringham into this, associate professor of economics and editor of a couple of books, author of a couple dozen articles, who has been writing a good deal about alcohol, coming maybe from a singularly different perspective. I ought to ask you first, Professor Stringham, about DISCUS, that is the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S., recommending you. I mean, you can't necessarily help who recommends you, but are there any funding connections there?
I have no funding connections with DISCUS or any other alcohol industry. But as I've said before, I will gladly accept donations.
Okay.
So my research is purely academic. I've been studying this for the past few years, and I've published a few articles on the alcohol industry. And I've examined studies such as this one and other studies. And what I found is that at first glance, they look extremely scientific. They mention a lot of key economics buzzwords. They talk about a lot of statistics, but when looking into them in greater depth, one finds that there's a number of assumptions which drive the results. So if people assume going in that alcohol is bad for the economy, if they assume that it's all costs, if they assume that there's no benefits whatsoever, it's not surprising that the results come in, down in such a way that says that alcohol is costly for the economy.
Right, now I've looked at some of your work, and essentially you say that alcohol helps the economy, particularly moderate drinking. That you've done some statistical analysis where you've gone into bars and decided from talking to folks that they can network and have social capital as a result of the connections in bars and drinking together, and that this makes people, well, more economically successful.
Right. So the standard assumption is that drinking is bad for you. Drinking decreases earnings. We actually looked at data for 10,000 people nationwide and found that looking at two otherwise similar individuals, the people who drink actually earn more money than people who don't drink. So for men, drinkers earn 10% on average more than an otherwise equivalent non-drinker. For women drinkers, they earn on average 14% more than an otherwise equivalent non-drinker. For men who go to bars, they earn an additional 7%. So rather than earning less money, they actually earn more money. And the hypothesis behind the findings is that people who are engaging in social drinking are engaging in social networking, which is a very important aspect of our economy.
Is there a distinction as to whether these are moderate drinkers or heavy drinkers?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Our data lumps together both moderate drinkers and heavy drinkers and finds even adding those two groups together, they earn 10 to 14% more than non-drinkers. So if we want to point to something as being perhaps inefficient, it might be non-drinking. I'm not going so far as to say that we should tax non-drinkers, but I will go so far to say that we should not be considering taxing drinking to the extent that this Marin Institute study is advocating.
And you're opposed to that because of the economic benefits you associate with drinking?
Well, there's the economic benefits just in terms of earnings, which are important. But the other thing that this Marin study is completely leaving out, they're only counting the costs. They are not in any way counting the benefits. So we mentioned that alcohol is in many ways embedded in everyday life. Lots of people drink. The vast majority of people drink. The vast majority of people drink responsibly. And to somehow pretend that we can eliminate this, as they thought we could do during Prohibition times, is reducing and restricting an activity which most people find important to their everyday life.
We're not just talking economics here. I think you would concede that alcohol has done a great deal of harm to families and has caused a lot of pain just in terms of the personal kind of pain that results sometimes, especially from abusive drinking.
That's definitely true that certain people do abuse alcohol, just as certain people abuse everything else, including television, the internet, eating. But I'm not sure that outlawing or highly taxing television, the internet, eating, or alcohol consumption is the appropriate measure when the vast majority of people who drink, drink responsibly.
Edward Stringham, again, is Associate Professor of Economics at San Jose State University. Fried Whitman, can we get a response from you?
Yes, I don't disagree with the idea that alcohol is associated with benefits, and it is, of course, a legal industry that employs a lot of people, and the alcohol industry provides a lot of public service, all of which is really not to the point about the harms and the need for correcting deficits in the operation of the industry where high levels of health and safety costs are being generated by the product which aren't being covered. So I think I don't know that we're actually having an argument about anything here. I do think it's interesting, though, to note that alcohol, drugs, tobacco, and so on are all items that one consumes. So what we're talking about here are consumption-based disorders where you actually have to consume the alcohol, the drugs, or the problematic eating disorders that fall in this category as well. And in that kind of disorder, it's important to look not only at the individual behavior, which Dr. Stringham's talking about, but also to take a look at the settings and the circumstances where that behavior occurs, because a lot of people's individual behavior is cued by those settings and circumstances in which they find themselves. One aspect of those settings is price. How much does it cost to drink compared to drink soda pop or coffee? A second is the occasion. Is it okay to drink a lot because everybody else is doing it, even though there's going to be problems afterwards, DUIs and fights and neighborhood complaints? I think we'd agree that in looking at managing those settings and circumstances, we're relying on the alcoholic beverage industry to do its part, especially the retailers, but also relying on local agencies, planning and zoning departments, police departments, responding to neighbor concerns and responding to other businesses to make sure that these facilities operate appropriately and do not produce excess police calls, do not produce excess DUIs. So there's a very important role in addition to the concern for individual drinkers for cities and counties to play in managing the settings where alcohol is used. And I think that includes with it taking a look at the costs associated, the negative health and safety costs associated with those settings.
But isn't it, Michelle Simon, unfair to put this tax on everybody who drinks, even, you know, people who are moderate drinkers or light drinkers who don't fall into the category of anything even resembling abuse?
Well, first of all, taxes are not actually assessed on drinkers. They are assessed on the manufacturers, the producers, and the importers. So I think it's important to understand that from a government regulatory perspective, it's actually industry who is taxed 20 cents a gallon for beer and wine. And
the consumer's going to feel it, though. I mean, they're going to raise the
price. What I'm saying is that it's up to industry to decide how to pass on, if they so choose, that increased cost to doing business. And they choose to do that in ways that make sure that the cheapest products remain cheap. If you go into Bayview Hunters Point, if you go into the Tenderloin, we actually released our study yesterday in Los Angeles, where people came from South Central LA to tell us that they are bombarded. Every block, every single corner of their neighborhood has an alcohol outlet on it with cheap booze, which is what is keeping people in their neighborhood suffering from this problem.
There, of course, is a whole other issue where the alcohol beverage stores are and in what neighborhoods and so forth. But I'm going to open up the phone lines because I know there are many of you who want to weigh in on this. And in fact, your calls are welcome. You can do that now. That is, join us now by phone, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. Or send an email to forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Alcohol abuse costs the state $38 billion annually, according to a new study that was released yesterday by the Marin Institute and causes more than 9,000 deaths. And we're talking about the possibility of raising taxes on alcohol, that is bringing up the amount of tax that's paid largely, as Michelle Simon said, by the industry, but that certainly would affect the consumer. Today, by the way, just incidentally, is the 75th anniversary of the day that the state of California ratified the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which, of course, repealed prohibition. With us, Michelle Simon, who is Research and Policy Director for the Marin Institute, and they're an alcohol industry watchdog group. That's how they describe themselves, a resource for solutions to community alcohol problems. Fred Whitman also with us, specialist with the Institute for the Study of Social Change at UC Berkeley and project director for the Community Prevention Planning Project, and Edward Stringham, who is associate professor of economics at San Jose State. And we also want to go to Philip Benoit this hour, who's media relations director with ChooseResponsibility.org, and they are a nonprofit organization dedicated to reducing the drinking age to 18 and promoting informed public debate and supporting what they call a fresh approach to the problem of reckless and excessive drinking, especially by young people. We talked about binge drinking as being one of the most serious problems that came out of this study. And Philip Benoit, good to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, a lot of people get really exercised when they hear reduce the age of drinking because they think it's going to create more drinking. You're saying just the opposite, huh?
Well, not quite the opposite. We are saying that the 21-year-old legal drinking age has had unintended consequences. For one thing, it has not, by any stretch of the imagination, eliminated the problem of 18 to 20-year-olds drinking. In fact, one of your guests earlier mentioned binge drinking as a great problem. That's a problem that has erupted much more in much more extreme fashion on college campuses and elsewhere in that age group since the passage of the national minimum drinking age law in 1984. So there are costs and there are consequences that are still happening in that age group despite the legal efforts to restrict drinking. It's somewhat like prohibition.
So why reduce the age? Are you saying that somewhat like prohibition in the sense that things that are subterranean now or hidden will no longer be and therefore will have better effect?
Exactly. Just as in Prohibition, people went to speakeasies where they were abusing alcohol, getting bad booze, and getting all kinds of difficult circumstances under which they were consuming alcohol. Today's 18 to 20-year-olds, particularly in the college environment, are engaging in surreptitious drinking or drinking behind closed doors because they can't drink legally out in the open. And that has driven the abuses of binge drinking that we're talking about, and finding that as a result of this kind of activity, we're seeing about 1,000 deaths a year from non-traffic-related alcohol incidents. And it seems to us that the problem is aggravated in that regard, and that bringing drinking out in the age, out in the open for legal otherwise adults who are considered adults in every other sense of the word, would allow it to be a public display where there would be intervention when abuses are likely to occur, or when there's inappropriate behavior, there are social controls that could kick in to dissuade the people.
But do you have any data to support what you're speculating with here?
You know, the 1,000 deaths a year is data. I don't have a source on that, I'm afraid, at this point, but there is evidence that that's a figure that is growing annually. 1,000 alcohol deaths every year in this age group through non-traffic relations, non-traffic data. There's you know, basically, the experiential evidence is that, you know, people who are dealing with this age group, particularly on college campuses, are finding that the problem is certainly no better than it was before the legal drinking age was raised to 21 than it was before, and that the abuses are probably worse in many respects because of the allure of the forbidden fruit kind of.
I understand that, but the logic sort of dictates that if it's harder to buy liquor because you're not 21, it's going to be harder to drink liquor.
Well, that doesn't seem to bear out in our experience. 18 to 20-year-olds report regularly that they are able to get the liquor that they want without any difficulties, and that people are there are ways to do this that they have become extremely proficient in, and that there someone who wants to drink is the least of their concerns is getting a hold of alcohol.
Fred Whitman, you want to say something here?
Yeah, the caller does have a point. Whatever age limit you set for drinking alcohol, people are going to break that limit and not obey it. We've done studies of drinking among students on college campuses, where particularly we're looking at undergraduates. And we do see that students under the age of 21 do drink less than the older students. And we see this particularly in licensed establishments, restaurants and bars. However, it's always the case that whatever age you set, you're going to see people drinking who, you know, are underage. In California, the age of first drink for many people is something like 12 years old. And there are many high school students who start drinking. There's a annual survey in California, the California Healthy Kids Survey, which shows a substantial amount of drinking by juniors in high school. So whatever age level you set, you're going to have drinking below that age level. The question is, at what age level, the age that you do select needs to be one that provides the best kind of solution for dealing with health and safety problems, at the same time recognizing people's responsibilities in adulthood and the norms that we live by. The age 21 came about as a result, as I'm sure the caller knows, of some highway traffic safety studies, which made very clear that 18-year-old drinking was resulting in a large number of excess deaths on the highways. And I think if we lowered back to the 18 age level, we'd probably see a resumption of those kinds of statistics.
Talking about first age of drinking, this is not advocacy, but my grandfather gave me a shot of bourbon, I think it was, when I was about 4 years old. And I'm a quasi-teetotaler, I think, as a result of just the burning sensation and the you know, sour taste that liquor has. Sorry, Michelle Simon, you're going
to
ask something?
Well, just to, you know, really get to the science on this, there's no question that since every state has raised the minimum drinking age to 21 as a result of being tied to highway funding, the traffic fatality rate has gone down. That is unequivocal. We have ongoing data to support that. And so the idea of going back in time to when we were essentially letting more people die because of a lower drinking minimum age is insane. And we need to look no further than other countries in Europe that have lower drinking ages, such as the UK, where it's 18, other countries where they are, in fact, considering increasing the minimum drinking age to 21, realizing they're making a big mistake because of their incredible binge drinking problems among young people.
Final word from you, Philip Benoia.
Yes. The data does show a reduction in traffic fatalities since the passage of the law, but that reduction takes place in all age categories. And in fact, the highest number of deaths on the highway due to alcohol causes is after age 21, 21 to 24, in fact. And we would point out that there are safer vehicles on the road than there were in 1984. There are more stringent drunk driving laws. They're better enforced. And there's just a whole lot of factors that come into that equation that I think may not be quite as clear in establishing a direct connection between the lowering of the drinking age and the reduction in traffic fatalities on the highway. And we would argue that, you know, there are damages from non-related traffic deaths by alcohol that would indicate that we should take a look at this and look at this more carefully and look at this data, have a debate about it, and see if it's time to let 18-year-olds who are adults in every other sense of the law, they can vote, they can be drafted, they can die for their country.
We don't have a draft anymore. Just in
they can enlist in the armed forces and any other kind of legal area that the age of majority is considered in. 18 years old is the age that is considered to be the appropriate age.
Well, alcohol, I'm glad you were able to speak to this, and I thank you for it. Again, Philip Benoit is media relations director for ChooseResponsibility.org, a nonprofit organization dedicated to reducing the drinking age to 18. I thank him, and we're going to go to our callers here. Actually, before I go to callers, Edward Stringham, let me go back to you. I've got an email here that says, correlation does not imply causality. It may be true that people who drink earn more, but it does not follow that they earn more because they drink. High performers may continue to enjoy above-average earnings even if they reduce their alcohol consumption. The speaker needs to demonstrate that increased taxes would reduce this putative gain in benefits to society more than it would reduce the well-documented harms.
Well, the first point is definitely true. Correlation never means causation. Whenever we're doing statistics, all we can do is look at correlations and then see, is this perhaps related? And an interesting study, we were talking about binge drinking a little while ago. Actually, there's another study that finds that people who binge drank in high school, 15 years after the fact, they actually end up earning more money than people who didn't binge drink in high school. And that one looks to be the case that people who were drinking in high school were building certain types of social skills that people who perhaps were staying at home playing video games were not building. So can we prove anything with 100% certainty with statistics? No. But I do think it is important when we look at what all businesses do in sales. Most businesses, they do engage in different types of socializing. And if we're going to eliminate this avenue for socializing, I think this is going to have serious bad effects on the economy.
Again, Edward Stringham is Associate Professor of Economics at San Jose State University and has published his work in the Journal of Institutional and Theoretical Economics and the Quarterly Review of Economics and Finance and the Journal of Labor Research. And let's go to your calls. John, good morning.
Yes. Within a mile of where I live is one of these big liquor superstores that just opened up, and it stocks enough hard liquor to keep everybody miles around drunk continually. And, you know, Safeways and 7-Elevens and other sources are stocking more and more liquors. And the fact is, supply and demand, if you cut down the supply, the price goes up and would be just as effective or more effective than taxing it. And I'd like comments on this.
All right. What do you think about cutting down the supply, Fried Whitman?
Well, I think there is evidence to show that limiting or restricting the supply without necessarily reducing the supply without necessarily eliminating it altogether does have effects in reducing consumption. There is evidence to show that earlier closing hours later in the evening, for example, are associated with fewer police events. There's also evidence to show that lower density of alcoholic beverages in terms of outlets per population or a number of outlets bunched closely together or outlets as a percentage that sell alcohol as a percentage of other outlets in the area that, you know, in commercial activity. When you reduce densities, you do reduce alcohol-related problems, both that are related to health problems related to consumption, and also in geographic areas where you thin out high densities of outlets, you will also reduce public problems, police problems. So there is evidence to show that.
Let's bring more callers on. Ray, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. My question is about what can be done to reduce the negative effects of alcohol that people are talking about without exactly going and drinking itself. I went to an undergraduate college that was, while I was there, very open and, you know, acknowledged that a lot of their underage students were going to drink and made it safe and easy for students to do on campus so they didn't have to drive off campus, they didn't have to drive back drunk. And in my senior year, they changed the rules and made it difficult and against the rules for students to drink on campus. And what ended up happening was they had a spike in alcohol poisonings because students drank secretively in their rooms and drinking large volumes all at once before they went out. And I'm curious if your panelists have anything to say about what can be done to attack costs directly or the negative effects directly, especially, you know, things like ride programs or things to reduce driving in general rather than just trying to stop everyone from drinking.
Now, Michelle Simon, come up with any conclusions that can answer the caller's question?
Well, of course, we need college campuses to be taking more responsibility for this problem. I mean, you have a situation where retailers are deliberately targeting colleges where you have at least half of the student population underage, which to me, you know, tells us that there's something wrong. But I think what this brings up more generally is the targeting of young people with alcoholic beverages. And one of the other campaigns that we've been very involved with at the Marin Institute is around Alcopops. And these are sweetened alcoholic beverages, essentially distilled spirits that come with fruity flavors and lots of sugar to acclimate young people to the taste of alcohol at a young age. So they serve as a nice bridge between soft drinks and hard alcohol. And what we're saying is these products, that the alcohol industry needs to be held responsible for targeting these types of products to young people, and they should be higher taxed, and they should be less available.
Let me thank the caller and go on to more calls in just a moment. But here's a listener who writes, I don't believe raising taxes of alcohol will reduce consumption. With cigarettes, it's estimated about a third of all cigarettes worldwide are sold on the black market. Why would this not start to happen with alcohol if taxes went up dramatically?
Well, it's true that there is, you know, the evidence with cigarettes is that if you go beyond a certain point in higher prices, that the bootlegging begins. But we're not even anywhere near that limit with alcohol. We are so far from that that it's not even worthy of discussion. I mean, you know, what we're talking about is 20 cents a gallon on alcohol tax on beer right now in California. And the UK, by way of example, taxes at $4.44 a gallon, seven times the rate that we do in the US. That's even taking in the federal tax. So we tax both federal and state. And so, you know, I don't think we have to worry about bootlegging until we even get to a point where we can compete internationally with our tax rates.
Here's another email from Lee in Palo Alto. It says, I've never been drunk, but I'm the son, grandson, and brother of alcoholics, so I've witnessed up close the personal devastation caused by alcohol abuse on both abusers and their loved ones. Based on this long experience, I suggest we amend the laws to treat all crimes committed under the influence of a mind-altering substance as premeditated. And another listener gets into this area of crime and alcohol. Martin writes, in discussing the connection between criminal behavior and drinking, it's important to look all the way down to the misdemeanor level. When I was a college student, yes, they had alcohol even way back then, I would have howled with protest about a drink surcharge to pay for the societal cost of alcohol consumption behavior. However, the cost of picking up that trash receptacle we thought it was so much fun to turn over after even a few beers is still significant when multiplied by the number of overactive young drinkers roaming our Saturday night streets. This is not a public confession. I invented the trash can episode to illustrate a point. My cohorts and I probably did a lot worse. All right, we'll go to more calls here. And Derek, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes, The Economist speaks to the fact that binge drinkers make more money, but it seems to me that are these people happier? Are they healthier? I mean, we know that in our society we have social diseases that have developed as a result of our materialistic ways. I wonder if...
Well, Edward Stringham, wait, were you saying binge drinkers are more successful? You're saying all drinkers, that includes
binge
drinkers?
Yeah, this is a separate study, in addition to mine, shows that people who binge drank in high school 15 years later earn more money. So that's in addition to our study, which lumps together moderate drinkers and heavy drinkers.
Do you know where that study appeared?
I don't have it right now, but it's referenced on my website, www.sjsu.edu/stringham, and another good website is alcoholfacts.org.
Well, the caller raises an important issue, though. I mean, in terms of health costs, you would certainly not deny that there are economic health costs to alcohol abuse.
That's true. For people who overuse alcohol, there are health costs. But for moderate drinkers, and actually in certain types of studies for heavy drinkers as well, people who drink are actually healthier. It's been proven in many different studies that moderate drinking reduces many different diseases, particularly heart disease. And so that's something that we need to consider. When I hear Michelle speaking, it's always, this is a problem, this is a catastrophe. Always looking at the negative things, why not look at the positive things? And to answer the caller's question, are people happier? I would say yes. People drink for a reason. People enjoy it. People who engage in responsible drinking do that for a reason. And to restrict this choice, the idea that we can restrict all choices as they were trying to do during Prohibition in the United States is not realistic. We can try and outlaw alcohol, but what happened during Prohibition is people just went underground. And when people go underground, you're removing their choices. You're taking a responsible social activity and pushing it to make it illegal.
Michelle Simon?
Okay, well, first of all, we're not denying that there are some alleged benefits. For example, at low levels of drinking, I think it's incorrect scientifically to say that there are health benefits to moderate drinking as defined by the federal government. So our study looked at moderate to high drinking, which is defined as three drinks or more per day. Every single day, drinking more than three drinks for men, more than one and a half drinks a day for women. Low amounts of drinking has been shown to have a benefit to certain segments of the population. I have to put all kinds of
caveats
on it.
It's in your report.
Yes, we say that low amounts of drinking can have a benefit for certain kinds of heart disease in certain segments of the population at older ages, a very minor effect, which by every scientific measure is far outweighed by the negative effects. No one is denying that enjoying some wine at dinner isn't an enjoyable thing, or going out with your friends for an occasional beer isn't an enjoyable thing. What we're saying is that harmful drinking, which is how our study is defined, is killing over 9,000 people a year, costing the state $38 billion a year. And we are not talking about going back to prohibition. All we're saying is, let's take a look at this. Let's have some government hearings about this. Let's see what kind of reasonable restrictions we can put on this devastating public health problem.
When you use a word with as much weight as catastrophe, you're doing that because of the harm that you see alcohol is causing, the harmful drinking that you just referenced.
That's right. Our study is looking at harmful drinking, people who are drinking more than just occasionally, three or more than three drinks a day, but every single day.
Fried, I'm sorry, you want to say something, Fried Whitman?
Yeah, I think there's a very important point underlying this discussion. The word catastrophe, I think, is a dramatic attempt to identify the extent to which huge alcohol-related costs are part of everyday life in California, particularly in health and safety services.
When you say costs, you mean personal and economic.
Personal and economic.
Catastrophic in both, yeah.
But I'm thinking particularly social and economic. Yeah. The personal costs to people who have personal problems with alcoholism and dependence, of course, are there, and they're going to be pretty persistent no matter what the levels of availability are. But the other group that Michelle was talking about earlier, the people who drink three or more drinks a day, of whom people who have alcohol dependence syndrome is a very small percentage, that large group of drinkers is creating huge costs on a daily basis. But it is so embedded in everyday life in California that we tend to take it as a given. What I think would be helpful here, and again, this identification of costs of alcohol that's just now come out from the Marin Institute, I've been in the field for 30 years, and I've seen similar kinds of reports come out about every 5 or 10 years. This isn't new. This is a repetition of things we've been seeing for some time. And as Michelle said, this is not new data. This is data that are standard data that are collected every day. So I think it would make a lot of sense to have some hearings and to try to make the extent to which alcohol is a part of everyday life in California a lot more transparent. For example, take a look at the extent to which alcohol is part of all police events. Right now, we're just collecting data on alcohol-specific events like drunken public sales to minors. But we know alcohol is heavily involved in assaults and other kinds of crimes, misdemeanors, and disturbances. It's not that hard to capture whether alcohol is involved in the event. We've got an officer on the scene. Let's collect that data and take a look at it. Let's take a look at the State Board of Equalization figures, for example, on how much alcohol is really being sold. And break it down by community so each community can see what its levels of availability are and take a look at the distribution of that availability in terms of the kinds of problems and experiences that they have. So the idea of a hearing would be as much to shed more light as to come up with action. And the more light is shed, I think the easier it will be to decide what actions to take. And
Let me just ask Edward Stringham, would you be opposed to a hearing that's being advocated here?
I think we could have a hearing, but I think we should be reducing taxes on alcohol. Right now, to mention, you asked my connection with the Distilled Spirits Council. They're not paying me to say this, but they have 50% of the price of spirits is due to taxes. And that's not the case in any other good that I'm aware of. That I think right now taxes are too high, and when I hear Michelle advocating increasing taxes by 1,500% on beer, which was a recent proposal, I'm not saying this is a good idea. If I may briefly, she mentioned this is just for heavy drinkers. Well, if you increase taxes on alcohol, that's increasing taxes on everybody.
But most people don't drink heavily. So it's really, we're not talking about...
Yeah, they're talking about proportionality.
Why tax everybody if it's just a few people that you're concerned
with? Because everybody is affected by the adverse impacts of alcohol. So we would all benefit if we increase taxes on everybody, we all benefit from the reduced harm that will result.
But you got the Joe Sixpack who's saying, you know, I'm not a heavy drinker, but I like my booze, I like my beer,
you know,
whatever.
What? I don't have kids, and I'm happy to pay taxes to go to education. We all pay for things as taxpayers that we don't necessarily personally benefit from, or we may have to, you know, have a little bit of a more hit for whatever reason. It's part of being a member of society to help pay for the harm. And really what I want to emphasize is that I want to get away from this conversation about taxing drinkers, who's drinking this much, that much. We want to hold the alcohol industry responsible. They are making money to the tune of $33 billion a year. And right now, they only pay about 1.7% of that amount into the state government in the form of taxes and fees. We want the alcohol industry to step up and stop talking about drink responsibly and pay their fair share of the cost they're causing.
All right, Michelle, people may want to read the report. They can get it online.
Absolutely, marininstitute.org.
And Fred Whitman, you have a website?
Yes, preventionbydesign.org.
And Edward Stringham, give yours again if you would.
sjsu.edu/stringham.
And that's Stringham.
S-T-R-I-N-G-H-A-M.
Thank you all. We talked earlier, by the way, with Philip Benoit, also media relations director. His website is chooseresponsibility.org. This debate will continue, and it has certainly stirred things up, and I'm glad that we had a chance to look at it from a number of different perspectives. I want to thank the guests who are here with us this hour. Michelle Simon, again, is research and policy director of the Marin Institute, and they are an alcohol industry watchdog by their own definition, a resource for solutions to community alcohol problems. Edward Stringham is associate professor of economics at San Jose State University, and Fred Whitman is a specialist with the Institute for the Study of Social Change at UC Berkeley and project director for the Community Prevention Planning Project. Another hour of forum coming your way. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk to the new poet laureate of the United States, Kay Ryan, who is a Marin County resident, in fact, lives in Fairfax and teaches at the College of Marin and has for over 30 years. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We always welcome your comments and questions about anything you hear on forum. You can email us forum@kqed.org or call 415-553-3300. Again, we talked to many trade and beverage companies, but they declined to be part of today's program. I want to also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Joey Kahn, Chaja Joffrey, Kelly Pretzer, Megan Rollins, and Allison Von Digelin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.